Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
Coming up, we'll revisit some of our favorite author interviews from the past year, including a book that takes a look at how from tacos to lo mein, culinary mixing is creating new food cultures across the country.
And are Black Americans losing interest in baseball?
But first, neuroscientist Lior Zmigrod has a saying, demography is not destiny. She came up with it to counter what she says is a misconception, that people's ideologies are shaped by their cultural identities. Zmigrod's research suggests otherwise, that the biological makeup of the human brain makes it uniquely susceptible to ideological suggestion. The better we understand that, she says, the better we can understand how and why so many are compelled by extremist political movements. Zmigrod explained the science behind all this in her book, The Ideological Brain. Our co-host Sam Dingman spoke with her about the properties of the brain.
It tries to understand the world, to predict the world, the past, the present, and the future, right? Because that's the way in which we can be successful in living in the world. We want a kind of accurate representation of the reality which we navigate. And that is a property of the brain that makes us incredibly intelligent, incredibly successful as a species. But it can also lead to a temptation for narratives that explain the world for us. And so that's why there's a kind of magnetism between what our brains typically do when they're at their best and what ideologies satisfy and what they offer in return, which are these really compelling narratives. But the problem is that those narratives can lead us astray in many ways, and they can even change the bodies of the believers in ways that can sometimes be toxic.
Yes, and this strikes me as this really important subtlety, which is that it's not that certain people, based on what kind of government they live under or where in the world they are, what race or gender they are predisposed to ideology. It's that the brain and ideology have this magnetic relationship.
Exactly. And so we can understand why all of us can be really prone to embracing ideologies to a kind of passionate degree. But by looking at the brains of people who are highly dogmatic and highly ideological, I've been also able to see, well, which people, which kinds of brains are the most likely to run towards an ideology when it comes around, you know, and to embrace it in the most extreme and passionate way.
And if I'm not mistaken, here what you're referring to is this notion of cognitive flexibility, right?
Yes. Yeah, so a lot of my research has looked at this trait called cognitive flexibility, or on the other side of the spectrum, cognitive rigidity. And one kind of test that I use to measure this is called the Wisconsin card sorting test, where people are sorting cards according to a rule which they gradually learn. So they gradually learn that when they match a red card with another red card, they'll get a really satisfying positive response from the game and they'll get points. And so they start kind of matching cards according to their color, a blue card with a blue card, a green card with a green card. And so they're playing the game, they've figured out this rule, they're applying this habit. And then without the participants knowing, the rule of the game changes. And some of us, when we encounter evidence that maybe we should change our behavior and look for a new rule, we'll adapt, right? We will look and say, well, actually, maybe I should match the cards according to the shape, like, you know, put stars with stars and cards that have squares with other cards that have squares. And we'll figure out a new rule and change our behavior. But other people, when they encounter the change, they will really resist. And they'll actually apply the old color rule again, even though all the evidence suggests that they should change their behavior.
Right.
And those are the most cognitively rigid people. And what's interesting, as you can tell, this task, this game has nothing to do with politics at all, right? It's just a game. But the way people play this game really predicts their ideologies.
You found that the more cognitively rigid someone is, the more likely they are to resonate with an extreme political point of view. which might seem obvious, but there's some nuance there, right?
Exactly. Because one of the almost surprising findings is that actually people who tend to be on the far right and on the far left are both characterized by this cognitive rigidity. So they're actually maybe more similar than they'd like to admit from a psychological perspective, you know?
I'm sure they would hate to hear that. Now, Lior, earlier, you also talked about how ideology can have these more physical effects.
Yeah. So one of the amazing things we're discovering through this new field called political neuroscience is how the biology of our brains, the biology of our nervous system can also relate to how extremely we adopt an ideology or which kind of ideology we most gravitate towards. So for instance, one of the findings that we're seeing repeatedly across hundreds of people in multiple countries is that people who tend to have right-wing beliefs and ideologies tend to have a part of the brain called the amygdala. It tends to be enlarged. And what the amygdala is responsible for is it's responsible for our processing of negative emotions like threat, fear, disgust of things that are foreign. And so there's this sense that maybe having this neurobiological disposition where you have a larger amygdala, that could potentially lead you to be more likely to adopt a right-wing ideology that perhaps also tends to echo those emotions in some of its rhetoric.
Yes. And this seems like another really important, delicate element of your research, which is that we don't yet know if politics impacts psychology or the other way around. But what we do seem to know is that what you call the resource environment in which the brain experiences ideologies is critical here.
That's right. So I can give an example of one study that looked at this. In this experiment, they looked at how much people are willing to share a little pot of money, of $10 that they have, with the faces of random strangers. And for some of these participants, they made them feel like, oh, they only have $10. That's really not that much. And for other people, they made them feel like, oh my gosh, $10, that's a ton of money that you can share. And when they were then invited to share that little pot of money with other strangers, with the faces of strangers, they saw that when people were in a condition where they felt that there wasn't enough to go around, their decisions about who to share their money with became more racially discriminatory. And broadly, what we take away from this is that being in an environment and potentially in the political environment where it feels like there's not enough resources going around, that kind of brings out the most discriminatory in us, even without our knowledge.
And this makes me think of a scrambling factor when we think of the resource environment, which is the internet.
Absolutely. When you think about what happens when you put brains that have all these psychological, even neurobiological sensitivities to taking an ideology to the extreme, and you put them on social media, which is an information environment designed to give them the most binary information, to give them, you know, the information that just confirms their beliefs, that doesn't challenge their beliefs, and information that's really emotionally negative, right? To make you feel threatened, to make you feel like there isn't enough to go around for your tribe or your group, you're really putting potentially very vulnerable minds in a very radicalizing environment.
Yeah.
And recognizing that, understanding how these ideological and digital settings really exploit our greatest vulnerabilities, I think it can be quite empowering because we have a better understanding of how these processes are working on and through us and what we can do about it.
Well, Lior Zmigrod is a neuroscientist and the author of the book, The Ideological Brain, The Radical Science of Flexible Thinking. Lior, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
From tacos to lo mein, some of the best food in America comes from immigrants to the country. Well, our next guest says some of his favorite meals come from the mixing of immigrant cultures. Think brisket tacos or using a tortilla to scoop up pork adobo. Rudy Guevara Jr. is a professor in ASU School of Social Transformation, and he's the co-editor of the new book, Culinary Mestizaje, a collection of essays and recipes that explores how racial mixing is creating new food cultures across the country. Guevara calls himself Mexipino. He's of Mexican and Filipino descent, and he told me he grew up surrounded by different cultures in San Diego.
I was exposed to Samoan food, because my father was also raised in the South. I grew up on soul food as well. And, you know, there was a lot of different culinary sort of things that we were exposed to with our friends and communities. And, you know, we would eat at each other's houses. And for me, I think growing up in these communities that were very multiracial, and the foods we had, what we shared with each other and our friend groups in many ways, really impacted me and sort of influenced what I would eventually do with my own research and writing.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a clear line there. So tell us like a favorite dish from your childhood, something that might encompass this kind of multiculturalism for us.
I mean, some of my favorite dishes are either Mexican or Filipino, but then, you know, we sort of say, for example, so for Filipino, you know, I really loved adobo, whether it was pork or chicken adobo. That was sort of one of the staples on heavy rotation, you know, in our household. But then there was also, you know, Mexican food. You know, my mom made a really amazing chile verde. Mm. You know, we had mole. We had like different other types of food, you know. But I think one of the things that I remember growing up is that because I was in a Mexican and Filipino household, we always had a pot of rice and we also had tortillas.
Yeah.
So let's say, for example, we had some pork adobo and we didn't have any rice. We ran out of rice. You know, I would just grab a tortilla, and scoop up the meat, and, you know, boom, you got a taco. It's
super
done.
Super good,
you know?
Yeah.
And then we just added the condiments on top, and that was it. So it was normal. It wasn't really like, it's just what we did because, you know, we just ate the food and you know, created these things with what we had.
Yeah.
And it was just sort of normalized because it was just part of our cultures and the blending and how it mixes, and it shows up in, you know, and one of the most amazing foods ever, and that's a taco, you know?
Absolutely, one of the most amazing foods ever. You and your co-editor here kind of traveled around the country cooking with some of the contributors to the book, gathering stories for it about various other kind of multicultural cuisines and the histories and cultures those come from. Tell us about the experience of creating this. It sounds like fun.
It was an amazing experience. And, you know, a lot of the people we approached were friends and colleagues and just people we knew throughout our lives that, you know, came from places that had multicultural or the intermixing of foods together in different regions throughout the United States and even in Hawaii. But also, like, you know, a number of the folks were also mixed race. So it's sort of like this thing of like telling a personal story that happens to sort of reflect what it means to grow up in these particular places and how food informed that identity.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there have got to be some kind of surprising combinations, food influences that you have highlighted here. I mean, you went all over. This is from, like you said, California, Texas, but there's Maine in here, Atlanta, Hawaii. What were some of your favorite kind of surprises, culinary surprises that came up?
I think one of the ones was, you know, for me, East Los Musubi, which, you know, our friend Natalie Santizo did, which looking at the sort of this Hawaii style food, right, the spam musubi, but sort of mixed with, you know, within a Mexican cultural intersection. And so I think that was something that was really interesting because you're getting, you know, these particular places coming together in Los Angeles and having this experience. And then, you know, you also go to Hawaii with our friend Rod Labrador, and, you know, he's talking about the history of the plate lunch and sort of how these certain things come together and why. And so you get a sense, a historical context of how these foods come about. And, you know, not just historical, but also in our contemporary moment, why these things come together.
Right.
And it makes sense. Once you read the stories and you understand, it makes sense. You know, everybody had their own story of how food and memory came together. And I think that was really meaningful in terms of how you could see what you sort of what we have in common and what brings us together with an intimate experience such as food and sharing food and combining food and sort of what those historical and contemporary moments look like in the creation of a dish.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder this because, right, like you're studying this, you're gathering stories, you're telling your own story here as well. But what does that mean to you? Like, what has learning about this and writing about your own culture and your own foods taught you about yourself?
I mean, for me, it's taught me that I'm not alone in this experience. And it's a beautiful thing because, you know, when you see all these different stories, you know, and, you know, I'm also mindful that these stories do come with, you know, a lot of luggage. You know, you're looking at white supremacy and racism and colonialism that occurred historically, which brings layers of moments when people come together whether in conflict or in cooperation. And over time, these things have shaped certain regions of the United States to create those moments where these now the individuals that have been combining their food have been able to then, you know, create something that's very reflective of their experience in their city or their region, whatever it may be. Those things all play a role in it. So it's not like just a kumbaya moment of coming together, but it has baggage that evolves over time. And this is what is sort of the creation or the moment that people experience in a dish that has all this behind it.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that I hope people can come away with, is that these things occur and they're continuing to evolve. And I think, you know, it's very reflective of our society as a multiracial society and what can come about when we come together and in these common experiences, rather than focusing on hate, hatred and fear and division and trying to really, in many ways, crush the voices of people of color and indigenous people who contribute and have shaped American food.
All right, we will leave it there. That is Rudy Guevara Jr., professor at ASU School of Social Transformation and co-editor of the new book, Culinary Mestizaje. Thank you so much for coming on, Rudy. Thank you for explaining this, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, college football promises players prestige, exposure, and opportunity. But what are the pitfalls?
But first, in her memoir, Whiskey Tender, writer Deborah Jackson Toffa tells the story of her family's transition from life on a Native American reservation in Yuma to a volatile border town in New Mexico. Along the way, she blends her own history with the painful realities of racism, police violence, and forced assimilation that have plagued generations of Native families. As Toffa prepared to write the book, she knew it would be important to illustrate the narrative with pivotal scenes from her youth. And when she spoke with our co-host Sam Dingman about it, she told him about the very first memory that came to mind when she started writing.
The one that came to shape, I think, quickly and was the thing that I first saw in the book was my Uncle Johnny's funeral. I was old enough at that point that I remembered much of it, the bird singers, the richness of the traditional experience, kind of in contrast to what had become by that point a mainstream life for me, because I was attending a Catholic school. The aboutness, though, of a chapter is always elusive, like figuring out beyond the anecdote, what is the deeper meaning in this? That was harder to come by.
Yeah. Well, you have a teacher at that time kind of talks to your class about what it means to engage with death, and the teacher's version of what that is ends up standing in really stark contrast to your experience, and it becomes a way for you of realizing this way that you're stuck between all these worlds.
Yes, Sam, that is a very good read. I mean, I think the thing that comes into relief in that chapter is the poverty of the rituals that are a part of post-industrial society, like the coming of age ritual of getting a driver's license replaces these profound indigenous coming of age rituals that I would have had if my ancestors had maintained their culture. And death is one of these things that becomes very watered down. And the beauty of indigenous rituals and the beauty of the cremation ceremony to me made such a big impact. It was probably the moment in my life where I knew I was facing a choice, whether or not I would find meaning in my life via American culture or whether I was going to bend towards an appreciation for my indigenous traditions.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things I really appreciated about that moment in the story is that there's actually a lot of nuance in terms of the cultural clash that's happening there, because the nun slash teacher that you have at that time is sort of appalled to discover that a lot of the kids in your class have never been to a funeral before. And she tells a very personal story about the death of her sister, but she tells it from the standpoint of death is something you should be exposed to so that you can just get over the fact that it's going to bring up big feelings and put those feelings away. And then you tell your story of going to a funeral where, in a way, it's a similar ethos. It's not hiding death from young people. You're there for it.
Right.
But it's very much about experiencing the feeling. It's very much about the momentousness of the emotion.
It is. There are designated criers, and it's a way for you to purge the pain, and these sort of the confrontation of death becomes something that is expressed so that that illness and that grief can leave your body rather than kind of balling it up inside and carrying it away, around in a way that's unhealthy. And the interesting thing about the nun in that year when I was in school was how wounded she still felt, because she felt complicit in her little sister's death.
But you're also hitting on something else that comes up in this particular chapter that I am keen to ask you about, which is another thing that happens when you get to this Catholic school is that you get recognized for your storytelling abilities. You give a recitation in front of the class, and I think it's a different teacher pulls you aside and says, you were excellent at that, and I'd like to have you get up in front of the entire school and do this recitation of Paul Revere's Ride, which is obviously a very patriotic American story.
Right.
So it's this interesting moment where you're being recognized as somebody with the capacity to tell stories in an impactful way, but the opportunity that you're given is to tell this story that has nothing to do with your own community's history and culture.
Right. It was the version of American history that is told and kind of excludes the country's origin story and the contributions of my ancestors.
One of the other elements of that in my mind is how perceptive you were as a child. I'm thinking in particular about there's a moment where you walk in and your dad is listening to a Richard Pryor record. And even though you're too young to understand the references that Richard Pryor is making, there's something about the way that he's reacting to the jokes on the record that you just kind of have this instinctive understanding that there's more happening than what you are maybe processing in a literal way.
As a child, the adults around me, they had such strong emotions. Everything was heightened. You know, when you come from a community that is struggling, you don't have sort of a daily status quo where things are rote and habitual. You have a lot of mood swings, and the energy that comes off of parents and relatives and neighbors, the painful aspects of their existence, it's hard to miss as a child. And so you develop a way of being on your toes because you're never sure what's going to happen next. In a community that suffers from pain and violence, it's actually crucial to your survival.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that before, but that makes so much sense. I mean, there's just so much dynamic energy in the air all the time in an unstable household that if you have your antenna up, it's just like there's constantly an invitation for you to try to make sense of it somehow.
That's exactly it. You put it very well. Yeah. And again, I think it's also tribal values very much speak to my desire to serve my community. And throughout my life, it's been really difficult to juggle those two oppositional value systems, how to pursue the American dream in a way that felt ethical as an Indigenous person. I hope that's what the book ultimately portrays, is the very difficult questions that we as Indigenous people face to make our peace with being American citizens.
Well, Deborah Jackson Toffa is the author of Whiskey Tender and is also the director of the Master of Fine Arts Creative Writing Program at the Institute of American Indian Arts. Deborah, thank you so much for this conversation.
It was a pleasure to speak with you, Sam.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The most recent opening day rosters across Major League Baseball featured more than 250 international players representing 18 different countries. But my next guest argues there's at least one demographic that's not represented in MLB as much as it could and should be. Gerald Early is a professor of African and African-American studies at Washington University in St. Louis and author of the book Play Harder, The Triumph of Black Baseball in America. He says African-Americans have been playing baseball for a lot longer than many people realize. And when I spoke with him, I asked what attracted African-Americans to baseball more than a century ago.
Well, I think in the 19th century, around the time of the Civil War, I think black people were attracted to baseball because it was a growing sport in the United States. It was a popular sport in the United States. I think partly black people wanted to play it because they felt it would make them seem more American. You must remember at this time, right after the Civil War, black people's citizenship in the United States was not settled until the passage of the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. And so playing baseball was a way of showing themselves as being American. I also think it was attractive because it showed black people could organize and do things for themselves. And organizing was very important for black people for the uplift of the race.
It's interesting because I think for a lot of Americans, they look at baseball as the sport that maybe reflects America or is thought of as quintessentially American. It's interesting that, you know, around the time of the Civil War, that was also seemingly the way that African Americans were thinking about it, too.
Yes, I believe so. Baseball is our oldest professional sport. And in this way, it has kind of some deeper roots than other sports. And I think it has a certain kind of tradition that Americans especially feel close to. Baseball represents a real sense of what America is about.
Let me ask you about the 1940s when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier, when he came up, of course, with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And I was reading some interesting commentary this year around Jackie Robinson Day, which is celebrated every year across Major League Baseball. And there were some writers suggesting that the true story of Jackie Robinson making it to the majors is not really told, in the sense that, yes, he was able to play and made the majors and broke the color barrier, but A, it was not that easy for him, and he endured horrible things both before and after. And also, it wasn't like that led to a flood of black players making it to the majors as well. I'm wondering what you make of that kind of criticism of the way that we celebrate Jackie Robinson and Jackie Robinson Day, and maybe think about how the color barrier in baseball was broken.
Well, Robinson, it wasn't easy for Robinson to do it. He had to endure a great deal. That's all true. And it didn't lead to a flood of black players. At least it didn't lead to a flood of black players on other teams. Integration was slow in Major League Baseball. Robinson, I think, prevailed largely because of his personality.
Why do you think it is that with Robinson's success when he made the majors and the Dodgers' success with him on the team, why didn't more teams bring black players aboard?
Well, you know, it's institutional structural racism, the racism of the old boy network in baseball. It was some owners believe, oh, you know, some owners believe that old Hollywood studios believe, oh, you know, sound movies, that's just a passing fancy. That's not really going to last. And, you know, black people in baseball, that's a fad. That's not really going to last. Some owners were afraid that it was going to alienate white people from going to ball games. They didn't want to do that, alienate white fans. So there were several reasons why owners were very slow about doing it. And they didn't feel as though they really needed black players. As time went along and black players had enormous success, outside success in the major leagues, integration began to pick up a little more and a little more. But also there were changes in the country that were happening that also propelled integration.
To what do you attribute the fact that even as, you know, it took so long for Jackie Robinson to break the color barrier, and as you've discussed, you know, a lot of teams didn't bring in a lot of other African-American players in the immediate seasons following. And yet it seems as though that didn't really cause a drop in interest among African-Americans to play baseball. I'm curious to what you attribute that.
Baseball was still the major sport in the United States. Robinson making it, in fact, made a lot of black people, Black players, Black athletes, think, oh, yeah, well, if he made it, I can make it too. So, no, there wasn't an immediate drop off in interest of Blacks wanting to play baseball. And the other thing is that even though some of the Negro Leagues died after Robinson made it in 1947, Negro League baseball still continued for at least another 10 years. So there were still players still playing in the Negro Leagues.
So what do you think then led to the drop off in participation in baseball among Black Americans? Because, you know, we see, for example, right now, Major League Baseball over the last few years has really been trying to make an effort to get more players from the African American community into baseball. What led to the decline in the first place, do you think?
Oh, that's, I think it was several factors led to the decline. Among them is that the rise of Black athletes having access to professional football and professional basketball as these sports began to really rise in America and become powerful presence in American professional sports. And also the collegiate element of both of those sports as well. And those sports also became basketball and football much more embedded in Black American school culture, both at Black colleges and also in Black high school culture. And baseball, on the other hand, did not become nearly as embedded in Black people's school culture as those other sports did. The other thing is that Black people as fans of the sport seem to have dropped off, and their interest in the game seemed to have dropped off as they drifted more toward basketball and football, especially as the number of Black people in those sports increased. The thing is that baseball in some ways may not feel terrific pressure about diversifying because so many Black Latinos play the game. There's not a lack of Black people playing Major League Baseball, playing professional baseball. It's just a lack of Black Americans playing it.
How important is it to have stars of the game, Black stars of the game, really make this a priority? I'm thinking of people like CC Sabathia or Mookie Betts, people who are, you know, not shy about speaking their mind and saying what's important to them. Are players like that or former players like that really able to make a difference here?
Anything helps. And if those players speak out and really make this a priority and really go to the Black community and preach the gospel of baseball. I mean, really go to Black schools and preach the gospel of baseball and tell those kids this is a great game. You know, it's a deep part of Black people's heritage. We used to have leagues, we organized teams. It is a deep part of your history. If people started preaching that a lot, yeah, I think it would have an effect. I'm not saying that by itself it would make a drastic change, but it would certainly be the start of something. Black people need to be reminded of how much baseball is embedded in their cultural heritage. It's like jazz. It's like ragtime. It's deeply embedded in Black people's heritage.
Gerald Early is a professor of African and African-American studies at Washington University and author of the book Play Harder, The Triumph of Black Baseball in America.
Back in 1980, Dora Rodriguez was one of 30 migrants who crossed the border into the United States, seeking refuge from the increasingly oppressive regime in El Salvador. The group entered Arizona from the southwest and made it as far as Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument before they ran out of water. Lost in the desert, the group endured days of starvation and violence before they were found. Only 13 of them survived, including Dora. The image of Dora's near lifeless body being carried out of the desert appeared on the front page of newspapers and sparked a movement to offer sanctuary to refugees from Latin America. Dora herself founded a nonprofit called SalvaVision, which connects migrants and deportees with various forms of aid. But for decades, Dora kept the story of her border crossing to herself. Then in 2016, she decided it was time to tell her story. Now she's published a memoir called Dora, A Daughter of Unforgiving Terrain. Our co-host Sam Dingman was struck by a scene early in the story when Dora was still a teenager living in El Salvador. She wrote about a song she used to listen to called Las Casas de Cartón. When they spoke, he began their conversation by asking her about it.
That particular song brought to us like the sentiment of a fight. Uh-huh. And it was also used a lot on protest when the University of my town, which was Santa Ana, were out there in the streets protesting the disappearance of students. Mm-hmm. And they will use that sound with big speakers, loud speakers. For me personally, it had a big impact.
Dora, do you remember how the song went? Would you be able to hum a few bars of it for us?
In Spanish?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Sí, decía, qué triste vive la gente en las casas de cartón. I am not a good singer.
No, that was wonderful. That's wonderful. Thank you.
It says, it's so sad to see my people in the houses or car boxes.
Meaning like sent away on trains?
Yes.
So then, as you write in the book, there comes a time when your mom warns you that you have to destroy this record, right, that you used to listen to, this record that had a recording of the song?
Yes, it was a particular afternoon that we were listening after school. And my mother came running and said, you guys need to destroy this because they're searching for homes. And that was a very common practice to just kick the door open for people from the government and go in your house without any warning and just check everything you had in your house. So my brother and I, we were together listening to the sun, and I grabbed it from his hand, and we had toilets, and we just destroyed it in pieces and threw him in there. Wow. And within minutes, the soldiers start knocking on our door. Wow. And I am sure my brother and I were still shaking, but we were composed, and we said, come on in, check. We don't have nothing to hide.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Dora. I mean, that scene for me was such a palpable illustration of the level of paranoia that you had to live with.
Yes, we did. As a young people, every day, every weekend, we would go to, you know, outside towns, walking, just hiking. But you can no longer do those kind of things because things were drastically changing in our community. And all you saw was trucks full of soldiers pointing guns, rifles, and it's very scary.
So at a certain point, as you write about, you, in conversation with your mom, decide that it would be better for you to try to get to the United States. And one of the things that you talk about is that you and your family had realized not just that it would be better for you to be in the United States, but that it would be safer for your family for you to be in the United States.
Yes, because I was the oldest one. And I was, from my three siblings, I was the more spoken and vocal and involved mm-hmm. in community activities.
Right.
So, and my mother was afraid that because they were going to come after me or they were going to look for me because my association with the Mary Knoll Sisters.
Yeah. And tell us, the Mary Knoll Sisters were a charitable organization that you were working with, right?
Yeah, the Mary Knoll Sisters were American nuns. They were placed in very marginalized communities in our country at that time to organize, not against the government, but to organize to make our communities better.
Yeah.
Like for us, we were trying to get a park going. We finished the park because of their support.
This is something you talk about very compellingly in the book, is this sense that even if the work that you were doing on behalf of people in the community had nothing to do with politics, even if it was just, as you said, trying to make life a little bit better, the government at the time was so paranoid that that might indicate that you had sympathies with revolutionaries that they were killing people in the streets.
Yes.
So you do decide to leave and try to make it to the United States. It took three attempts, and much of the book is focused on that third attempt, which, though it was ultimately successful, is an unbelievably difficult story to read. And you're so honest about the horrors that you survived trying to make it through the desert with the other people who you were with.
Yeah. When you go through a tragedy like that, it just, you have it for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
But I was able to place it in a compartment in my heart, in my brain, in my soul, that it wouldn't attack me every day to survive. But I always had that in my mind that someday before I got too old, I wanted it to put this in a book. It has not been easy. Yeah. It's been hard. In the process of writing, I would have woke up at midnight and, you know, just crying and scared and thinking, whoa, it was there. It never went away.
Well, and just to give listeners a sense of what we're talking about here, and a warning, you know, this is very difficult to hear, but you talk about reaching the point where you and your fellow travelers had to drink your own urine to survive because there was so little water. You talk about some people being so exhausted from the heat and feeling so lost and hopeless that you would ever make it to your destination that they started asking each other just to let them die there in the desert. You write about one of the people you were traveling with starting to sexually assault the other women on the trip. It's just awful. I got the sense from the way that you wrote about it in such a clear-eyed way that it was important to you for people to realize.
Yes, and I opened my story because I felt morally obligated to humanize who we are and why people leave their countries. I want people to know that behind each person that is criminalized and arrested and put in detentions and separated, it is a whole family, a whole community that suffers.
Well, Doro Rodriguez is the director and co-founder of SalvaVision, but also the author of the new memoir, Dora, A Daughter of Unforgiving Terrain. Dora, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. When Tracy Canada was an undergrad at Duke University, she found herself living in a dorm with a bunch of members of the school's football team. She found herself fascinated by their unique status on campus. In a way, they were kind of TV stars, appearing regularly in nationally televised games. They were often given free gear from prestigious brands like Nike, and they walked around campus in brightly colored uniforms with the school's name on their chests. But Canada couldn't help noticing that they were also, in many cases, black men. And that meant that in spite of their prestige, they were also subject to the same challenges and pressures that other black students faced. These experiences inspired the research Canada went on to do for her PhD, much of which she chronicles in her book, Tackling the Everyday. The book explores the delicate role that black college football players are asked to play. Our co-host Sam Dingman spoke with Canada. She told him that when she started writing it, the NFL was in the midst of the controversy surrounding Colin Kaepernick's on-field protests and players at the University of Missouri threatening to go on strike. She figured it would be easy to get players to talk about race, but it wasn't that simple.
And one of the first things that somebody on the team told me that race didn't matter there. So something that they took into account. And this was a player that was active on the roster, right?
Uh-huh.
And I was so fascinated by this statement. I was like, I'm going to hold on to that.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's something in the way that you are analyzing your own experience that to you, it's not a thing.
Yeah.
But when I would go to practices and I would see a coach telling players to just go to the sidelines, they were going to work on something, right? And almost evenly split, all of the white players went to one side and all of the black players went to another.
Wow.
I was like, this is a fascinating display.
Wow.
Like, you not thinking that race matters, which is fair, right? Like, if that's the way that you're you're analyzing this experience. But to me, it was fascinating the way that they just so immediately split.
Yeah.
So those were the types of scenarios and situations where I was like, okay, there's something here, which is how this ended up being a book about relationships, about the way that people interact with each other.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about that, because one of the things that you are highlighting in this book is this idea of football and maybe sports more broadly being marketed to athletes as a source of family, and that there are some ways in which it mirrors those structures, and that there are some ways in which that is a bit of a false promise, right?
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think football is uniquely positioned in this, because the idea of the football family is something that is constantly repeated. It's a helpful analytic for administrators, for institutions to call it a family, because that's a way to get all of those people on board, right? To say that, like, you're all working together, you all want what's best for the person beside you. And really what that means is that we all want to win, right? That does not necessarily mean that there's a vested interest in the individual well-being of all of the people who make up that family.
Right.
And we have to keep in mind that the majority of the people who make up this quote-unquote football family are football players themselves. And without the football players, none of this works. If they stop playing, if they are no longer invested, if they get too injured, right? Like, this goes away. This version of family is very invested in something that I call corporeal concern, which is this idea that the body has to be healthy enough and interested enough in playing football on behalf of this team and this football family,
yeah,
right? And if that body is no longer able to produce on behalf of the family, then it's no longer useful.
Yeah. And it so flies in the face of what, you know, I think many people would think of as a familial relationship with a physical body, which is that maybe even more when a family member's physical body becomes unwell, our level of care and attention increases. It doesn't decrease.
Right.
One of the other things that you talk about, and it feels related to this idea of care and who's caring for who, is what type of masculinity is welcome in these environments.
Yeah, that's a part of the book that I think comes from the fact that I am a Black feminist scholar. One part of that that is, I think, important is also the focus on mothers. So I do have a whole chapter in the book about the players' mothers in a way that I think gives visibility to the labor that they also contribute to this entire system.
Mm-hmm.
But the other, like the twin argument that's happening in the book is to say that these are quite intimate relationships that players have with each other. There's an intimacy of football because tackling requires you to get really close to another person, right?
Yeah.
And your body is coming up against somebody else's body, right? Like, there's a particular intimacy that's involved in this sport. But then there's also the side of, like, what it means to be living in this particular body at this particular time when there are so many violences that are often enacted against Black male bodies. Mm-hmm. So being aware of that experience as well means that Black players are able to see each other in a very particular way that is often not replicated with other people. There's a certain type of care that then comes with that of, like, I'm going to care for you. I'm going to make sure that you are okay. There's a particular assumption that we have about football players because of what is required from the sport. It's violent. It's dangerous. It's loud. And the type of person that you think needs to play that sport, you don't often also say, oh, but he, like, has this really sweet relationship with his mom. Someone who takes time out of his day to go visit his teammate in the hospital because he's been hurt and his family can't fly into town yet. So he's going to go sit with him in the hospital room while he waits for surgery until his family comes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is such a beautiful example that you just shared, because to me, that links back to what we were talking about this familial relationship with the body rather than the institutional.
Yeah, I do want you to be well, and I want your body to be healthy, right? Like, I want your body to be functioning. Part of that is that so that you can play football if that's what you want to do. But also, I'm trying to make sure that, like, when we both get out of here, when we both graduate, when we both leave this place, we are okay, right?
Yeah.
And whatever way that that means, that we are able to live our lives past this experience.
I want to make sure that we touch on the chapter about the mothers, which you alluded to.
Moms are integral to the entire thing. Actually, without their buy-in and without their support, college football doesn't exist. They are usually the ones that kind of stamp the approval to say that it's okay for their son to go to that college to play.
Yeah.
So coaches know that. And so they're figuring in that way. But then spending time with these mothers, I would hear these stories of how they were the ones that would wake their sons up in high school to go work out or practice with them at 6 o'clock in the morning before they went to work.
Right.
They're the ones who travel every week to a game, whether or not the son is playing. They travel every week to the game. Like, they organize the family dinner that happens after the game. They get everybody together for the carpool, right? Like, that's the type of work that they're doing in that way. Mm-hmm. So they want them to be successful on the football field. But then after the game, they're asking them questions about, like, okay, have you done your homework? What do we need to do here? Do you have enough food? Have you done your laundry? Yeah. Like, who's this friend? Who are you talking to? Right? Like, they're asking them questions about their life away from football because they want them to have this, like, general well experience that's, like, more holistic. And because these were Black mothers as well, who are themselves uniquely positioned as Black women in the world, they also have an understanding in a completely different way of these experiences of anti-Blackness that their sons might experience and probably have already experienced by the time that they get to college.
Right.
And so not only are they concerned with them being okay on the football field, not only are they concerned with their life in college, but they're also hoping that they live past college.
Well, I have been speaking with Dr. Tracy Canada, who is the Andrew W. Mellon Assistant Professor of Cultural Anthropology at Duke University and the author of the book we've been talking about, which is called Tackling the Everyday. Dr. Canada, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, that'll do it for this special books edition of the show. Remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at theshow.kjzz.org. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.